Hey, how are you?
Just a quick announcement. Following with the mindfulness topic from last week, we're going to offer a yoga and meditation class to you guys in Holden Chapel on the following four Thursdays. So starting next Thursday, April 27th, and then running May 4th, 11th, and 18th in Holden Chapel. And in case there's a lot of interest, we thought we'd cut down on interest by holding it at 9 o'clock in the morning. So 9 to 10, there'll be a half an hour of hatha yoga, gentle, and then half an hour of seated meditation and breathing practices.
Hi, everyone. On a related note, I'm working with some students who are interested in creating a group for yoga. Our goal will be to help people explore their interest in yoga, advance their practice of yoga, and deepen their understanding of yoga themselves through the practice of yoga and meditation. So my name is Brittany Novak. You can contact me. My email is bnovak. I'll be posting that on the class blog. So if you're interested at all, please let me know. Thank you.
Debbie?
Hey guys, I just wanted to tell you that this Saturday, the Harvard Radcliffe Chinese Students Association is going to be turning the fourth floor basketball courts of the MAC into a laser tag arena. So if you're interested, we're going to have 10-on-10 games of laser tag from 7 to 9 p.m. on Saturday. So bring your friends. It's $3 for Harvard students, pre-frosh play free. So if you're interested in bringing your pre-frosh, having a good time with them, that'd be awesome. And also, thanks to Tal, you can see our great promo video on the class website. It features Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, so check it out. Thanks.
There's a lot of activities this weekend. On Saturday, we have Presencia Latina, Latin Presence. It's the annual Latin Latino cultural show at Lowell Lecture Hall. You can purchase tickets at the box office, and it's this Saturday at 4 p.m. and then again at 8 p.m. You can see salsa, bachata, Aztec dance, baile folclórico, capoeira, cumbia. You can see it all. So if you're interested, again, Presencia Latina at 4 p.m. and 8 p.m.
Hi, good morning. Welcome. Okay, so what are we going to do today? We're going to be talking some more about love. And today we're going to get to the interesting part. We're going to talk about attracting love into our lives. And we're only going to start talking about it today because in many ways the next two lectures on self-esteem are about that. So where did we leave off last time? Last time what we spoke about was some of the myths and facts regarding romantic relationships. Romantic relationships, broadly defined, whether it's marriage, whether it's a long-term relationship, again, beyond the honeymoon stage, and that's the key critical element here, as we'll talk about later. Same sex, different sex, marriages, relationships, and we're going to elaborate a little bit more on these today. One of the myths about relationships that we discussed was that the best relationships, the gold standard, the role models, are relationships that are completely harmonious. No disagreements, no fights. And what Gottman showed, Gottman, probably the leading researcher in the topic, the one who can predict with 94% accuracy whether relationships will last or not. What he shows is that the best relationships are not conflict-free. Rather, they have a very specific ratio of positivity to negativity. 5-to-1, positive to negative ratio. If the ratio says 50-to-1, what that means is that the partners are probably ignoring a lot of the disagreements. They are avoiding rather than coping. They're not learning from failures. And that ultimately is not healthy in a relationship. The healthy ones have this ratio. What does this mean, this 5-to-1 ratio? Again, more or less. It means that what we need to do, what we need to focus on relationships, especially in relationships where there is a lot of negativity, you know, in relationships where there is, quote unquote, too much positivity, it just means we need to open up more issues, discuss more issues, be real, in other words. There are no perfect relationships. Such a thing doesn't exist. But in relationships where there is too much negative, the key is, to use the popular phrase, accentuate the positive. Doesn't mean eliminating the negative. That's impossible in healthy relationships. And in many ways, if you think about it, this is what positive psychology is about. This is what we've been talking about since the beginning of the semester. It's not about ignoring psychopathology. It's not about ignoring depression. It's not about ignoring anxiety. It's about shifting the pendulum. So there is also research on happiness, on well-being, on joy, on satisfaction, on strength, on gratitude, on self-concordant goals, and so on. And the focus is not merely on anxiety, neurosis, psychosis. Important, don't eliminate this research, far from it, but the shift of the pendulum from a 20-to-1 ratio between negative and positive research to something a little bit more balanced. And in the area of relationships, we actually have scientific evidence to show what the right ratio is between positivity and negativity. Now, how do we accentuate the positive? Some concrete tips from Gottman. The tips are very simple, no rocket science, commonsensical even. But as Voltaire said, common sense is not that common. It's not that common in relationships, unfortunately. Now, when you go on a date, you sit down, I don't know, in one of the cafes here. You can tell which are new couples and which couples have been together for long. Why? Because the new couples are usually sitting the edge of their seat, right? Stoop forward, listening. Sometimes they're also playing with their feet, right? You can tell. Whereas other couples, you know, are more reclined backward, you know, they're eating their food, but not really interacting. These must be couples who have been together for a long time. That's a problem. You know what it's like? It's like the gratitude idea that we discussed. We learn to take the best things in our lives for granted. It applies to the food we eat in the dining hall, and it applies to our loved one. By showing interest, going out of our norm, even though we get used to the status quo, even though we're change detectors, making an effort to show an interest, asking questions, to touch, to smile, to play footsie. These are important little things that make a big difference. Compliments are free, but they yield a lot of reward in the ultimate currency. Mark Twain, I can live for 2 months of a good compliment. Now, my father-in-law went on a date with his wife, and she was wearing a beautiful evening dress. And by the end of the evening, you know, they went home, and she said to him, "You know, Ami, many people gave me compliments tonight, told me how beautiful I looked. Except for you." And he said, now he's very, very shrewd, he's a Harvard Law School graduate, he said, "Sweetheart, do you remember when a couple of months ago I told you were beautiful?" She said, "Yes, I do." "Well, unless you hear otherwise, you're beautiful." But you know what? Wasn't enough. Guess who slept in the doghouse? Yep. You know what? She's a lawyer, too. Don't take things for granted. Just like we do the gratitude, what is gratitude exercise all about? Saying thank you, paying a compliment to reality, to God, to whatever, to the chef, to your best friend. Do that in relationships as well, whether you've been together for a day or for 10 years. Put yourself in the other person's shoes, show empathy, identify with them, try to really understand them, and I'll talk much more about it shortly. And finally, let me state the obvious. Sex is love concretized at its highest. Now, how we do it, how often we do it, is up for you two to decide. The important thing is to discuss these issues. To discuss these issues, not just to leave them and say, well, things will work themselves out. Because very often we have different interpretations of what's enough lovemaking, what's too much lovemaking. Let's look at a clip of these different interpretations.
That day in Brooklyn was the last day I remember really having a good time.
We never have any laughs anymore is the problem.
I've been moody and dissatisfied.
How often do you sleep together?
Do you have sex often?
Hardly ever, maybe 3 times a week.
Constantly, I'd say 3 times a week. Like the other night, Albert wanted to have sex.
She would not speak with me the other night, you know?
Just... And I don't know, I mean, 6 months ago, I would have done it. I would have done it, just please.
I tried everything, you know? I put on soft music and my red light bulb and...
But the thing is, I mean, since our discussions here, I feel I have a right to my own feelings. I think you would have been happy because I really asserted myself.
The incredible thing about it is I'm paying for her analysis, and she's making progress, and I'm getting screwed.
I don't know, though. I mean, I feel so guilty because Alvy is paying for it. So, you know, so I do feel guilty if I don't go to bed with him. But if I do go to bed with him, it's like I'm going against my own feelings.
She's making progress, and I'm not making any progress.
I don't know. I can't win.
Then her progress is bringing on progress.
Sometimes I think I should just live with a woman.
We'll talk about that in a minute. So what is the issue here? The issue is lack of communication to each other. And the important thing about all these issues is the communication. Why? Because love is not just about emotion. Lust is primarily about emotion. Sustained love, sustained happiness within a relationship has to transcend just purely emotions. It has to have both. The philosopher Pascal, the heart has its reasons of which reason knows not. He's partially right, but only partially. Because yes, while we can't always explain why we fall in love with someone, it is important to understand what are the values that are important to us in a relationship, what we're seeking, and to communicate these. In other words, to introduce reason into the relationship. Now, if I didn't think that was the case, I wouldn't be teaching a class on relationships. I mean, what we're doing now is we're dissecting the conditions that lead to happy relationships. What we're going to talk about shortly is what can bring more happiness to our lives, more love to our life. In other words, it doesn't just have to do with emotion. It is also about reason. The problem is that in our culture, there's a lot of misconception thinking that if we bring reason in, it will take out emotions. It will take out the emotion of love, which is not the case. Nathaniel Brandon, there are many people who are heavily invested in the belief that love is inherently mysterious and mocks all efforts at rational understanding. Such people may even believe that understanding kills romantic love. This is tantamount to saying that consciousness kills. The exact opposite is true. Unconsciousness kills, ignorance kills, blindness kills. If we cannot deepen our grasp of at least some of the essentials needed for the success of romantic love, then there is nothing waiting ahead but more centuries of the same suffering between man and woman that we have behind us. Centuries of suffering, not just behind us, also around us. For example, in other countries where there isn't an understanding that equality is a prerequisite for romantic love. And he's talking here about relationship between man and woman. It's even more applicable to same-sex relationships. Research recently done about same-sex couples by Otis showed that one of the causes of stress within the relationship is people's perception, for example, homophobic feelings about these relationships. And when it's prevalent in the culture, these feelings are often internalized and not just hurt the culture, they also hurt the people within the relationship. In other words, reason and understanding and making sense of one's feelings is not just important when we talk about society-wise, it is important even for the individuals experiencing the relationship themselves, especially about relationships where there is a lot of misunderstanding and lack of acceptance. There was a lot of it throughout the ages for same-sex relationships as well as for man-woman relationships, and it continues to be so. Reason is critical, and again, I wouldn't be teaching this class if I didn't think it was important to understand these issues, and if I didn't think it was important for each person to understand his or her own relationship. And how do we understand it? Through reflection, through observation, through asking ourselves, what are my values? What do I really, really want in a relationship? Because when we ask these questions, very often we're able to overcome stereotypes, prejudices, because we're certain of our wants, because it's not just a whimsical idea that we have. It is well grounded in our understanding of who we are. Here are some of the essentials to bring reason to relationships. Here are some of the essentials of romantic relationships. Before we can even go into it, we need to understand the state of affairs. And what we can see is that the state of affairs is not great because 67% of marriages end up in divorces, because the remaining 33% very often are unhappy, because numerous men and women have affairs. So what do we do about it? Do we just say, well, it just wasn't meant to be, it was an experiment, this kind of relationship, experiment that has failed? That's one of the conclusions. Another conclusion is to say, what does positive psychology have to teach us? What does positive psychology do? Remember, in terms of the research, it does two things. First of all, it looks at the tip of the stem. It looks at the things that work. And the second thing that it does, it changes the focus from the negative to the positive, from the negative to the positive, and then looking at the very best. So going back to our second lecture, when we talk about low-income population, at-risk youth, the question that psychology has asked for decades was, why are so many of these kids failing? Positive psychology came along and asked a very different question. Focusing on the people who succeed, positive psychology asked, why do some succeed in inner cities, in low-income families? And then it studied them and it came up with the idea of resilience. And that resilience was then applied to all kids. Different question, different answers. The same with studying relationships. Instead of asking why do so many relationships fail, it's about asking what makes the few relationships successful. Let's study them, let's look at them, and let's apply what we learn from them into our lives. John Gottman has this to say: at first, when I figured out how to predict divorce, I thought I had found the key to saving marriages. But, like so many experts before me, I was wrong. I was not able to track the code to saving marriages until I started to analyze what went right in happy marriages. Before, negative psychology. Why are there so many divorces? How can you predict it? After, a very different question. Why are some relationships so happy? What makes them so good? Tip of the stem, focusing on the positive. And here he got a lot of his answers. Let me go over a few of these answers, also answers from Nathaniel Brandon, from the Myrie couples who write in positive psychology. Some of the characteristics. First of all, being together by doing together. It is not enough for couples just to get married and then to live happily ever after. It just doesn't happen this way. Again, only in movies do we see that, not in real life. Let's draw on research from negative psychology, from the other side of psychology, which is critical here. I mentioned this early on, but let me go over it again very briefly. Until around 1958, most researchers believed that all you need to do in order to overcome conflicts, to overcome prejudice, is to bring people together. Gordon Allport, who taught here, spoke about the contact hypothesis. Bring conflicting groups in contact, and you will solve prejudice. You will solve stereotypes. Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954. They said, well, we just need to bring people together, and then we won't have the stereotypes anymore. We won't have prejudice anymore. But what researchers and reality showed us is that it's not enough. It is just not enough to bring people and get them to play in the same sandbox, and then we solve all the problems. What we need, as Sharif and other researchers later showed, we need to get the two sides together, working together on something that they couldn't accomplish as well by themselves. In other words, on a superordinate goal that makes the two sides interdependent. Now, in relationships, as we've spoken about earlier, there are always conflicts, inevitable. The question is, what do we do with these conflicts? Do we just say, okay, I found, you know, the person of my dreams, and we just, you know, eat together perhaps, and then share the same bed? But that's not enough, not for sustained love. For sustained love, we need much more than that. We need goals that are meaningful for both of us, and we need to do them together. That could be things like volunteering in a homeless shelter together, running a political campaign together, raising children together. Not that one person does it and the other person works, but together. And if both work, then both work. Identifying meaningful goals, just like for personal happiness, we need meaningful goals. The same for relational happiness. We need meaningful goals. John Gottman has this to say. In the strongest marriages, husband and wife share a deep sense of meaning. They don't just get along. They also support each other's hopes and aspirations and build a sense of purpose into their lives together. Love has to be active. It cannot be passive after we get married. Again, love begins where movies end. This was made very clear to me after a story my friend told. One of my closest friends in Israel had his first child. He had his child when he was much younger than I was, so that was close to 10 years ago. And he said at the beginning, he studied psychology too, and he said at the beginning, when the child came home, the emotion that he felt toward the child frightened him because he didn't experience love. He said, I almost felt indifferent to the creature that was lying here, even though it was my son, and it frightened him. But it didn't come natural as he expected it to come. But then, in an equal relationship, he had to share the burden. He couldn't carry the child for 9 months, but he shared the burden after. And what does that mean? Maybe you don't want to know. Well, it means feeding the child. It also means changing diapers. It means taking the child for a walk. It means helping him fall asleep. And he said within a week of diaper changing, he fell in love. Why? Because he was invested in it. Because it was active love. It wasn't just, okay, so I'm watching my wife's belly grow for 9 months, and then at the end of it, something comes out. I should be in love with that thing. It doesn't work that way. Sometimes it does. Some cases it does. You know, the first thing, just the baby comes out and it's that. But very often it has to come through action. The same with relationships. Think about a relationship that you're starting as having a lot of potential, as a seed. Now, what happens to a seed if you don't nurture it? Even if it's a strong seed, a beautiful seed, with all the potential in the world, and you don't nurture it, it will wither and die. No different with a relationship. We have to nurture it. We have to be active. One of the ways to nurturing it is getting to know one another. And when I say getting to know one another, I mean really getting to know one another. It's not just what's your favorite color and what's your favorite restaurant. It's where do you like to be tickled? It's what are your yearnings? What are your aspirations? What are your fears and insecurities? Who are you really? Study your partner. You know, one of the reasons why a first date looks very different from a 100th date, it's because we stop studying our partners. Now, one could say, well, how much can you study a person for an entire life? We can study ourselves and always discover new things about ourselves. Why not do the same with another person? And again, looking at the tip of the stem, looking at successful relationships, what we see is that they continue to study one another for their entire lives. And therefore, when they sit down in Pinocchio's on a date, they sit like this, even after 100 or 1,000 days, and they still play footsie with each other because they're always learning, they're always discovering, just like we're constantly discovering ourselves. You know that when we look at self-esteem, and we'll look at it next week, self-esteem generally increases over the years. Not always, but generally, there is an upward trend. Why? Because we get to know ourselves better. Similarly, love can increase over the years if, and I'm picking my words carefully, and only if we get to know our partners better. Gottman talks about creating love maps. Again, where do they like to be tickled? What do they love to eat? When are they upset? We study them, and we know them, and they become part of who we are. And we know them as well, or almost as well. David Schnark. If there's one book you want to read on relationships, especially on long-term relationships, it's this. This single sentence literally, and I mean literally, transformed my relationship with my wife. You see, because what I'd read, until I read David Schnark, when I read about relationships and studied relationships, what most experts on relationships say is that the most important thing in a relationship is to experience validation. You want someone who will accept you unconditionally, who will love you no matter what, who will validate who you are. And that's right. It is extremely important, and we'll talk about how important it is in a moment, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing when we get into a relationship is opening up and being known. Not being validated, but being known. Getting our partner to really know us, the beautiful parts in us and the ugly parts in us. Because if we hide from our partner, we cannot sustain long-term relationships. And Schnark has shown this on hundreds, if not thousands, of couples that he has studied over the last 30 years. What does that mean? Let me give you an example. So Tuesday, after the class, I felt great. I had office hours after, you know, time for my introvert self to thrive one-on-one. I had a wonderful time. 5 o'clock, office hours ended. I was just about to leave, and I get a phone call from an organization that I do work for, a lot of work for, over the summer. I'd given them a proposal, very long, elaborate proposal. They didn't like it. Now, in and of itself, fine, they didn't like it, but that meant that I have to write another proposal, and I don't have the time. Between the two classes that I'm teaching, spending time with students, spending time with my family, I was hoping that once I handed in this proposal, which I handed in before the semester, I could relax until the summer. So that came in and really threw me off. Then a few other things happened. It just wasn't my day. I didn't wake up great, wasn't that happy in the morning. And then Wednesday afternoon came. Every Wednesday afternoon, I have a date with my wife. We have a date where we put time aside, Wednesday afternoon and Friday afternoon. We see each other a lot, both of us work from home mostly, but these are our intimate times together. Why? Because we found out that if we don't put time aside, other things will take over. And we won't get to spend quality time together. So Wednesday afternoon came. And initially my inclination was, okay, all I need to do now is to be held and validated. And then I thought about this. No, I'm going to be known. Even though we have, you know, 3 hours together now, I'm going to fully express what I'm feeling, what I'm going through. Some of the things I wasn't happy about experiencing, but again, permission to be human. And I opened up to my wife. I shed some tears. Wasn't a good day. And within about half an hour, I was a different person. Again, I'm not going to bother you with the details of what happened after. Barry, can you lower the lights a little bit? Just thanks. But this is the difference between being known and being validated. What am I doing here now? Right here with you. I'm being known. I'm opening myself up. Yes, it's embarrassing to me. I'm blushing. Big deal. I'm human. Since when has blushing become a problem? Giving ourselves permission to be human. And that's even more important in a relationship, because if I go into a relationship without opening up, how can I create intimacy in that relationship? Lust cannot sustain itself just purely on the physical level. There has to be intimacy, there has to be openness. In other words, I need to go in expressing rather than trying to impress. How much easier is it? And think about every domain, not just about romantic relationships. Teaching, for instance. I know when I started teaching, I would go in and I'd say, I want to put on my perfect self in front of the audience. And what that meant was not showing vulnerability, not opening up too much. There was a lot of pressure on me to be the ideal teacher. And then over the years, especially after starting to read this, I said, well, what I want to do is be known to my students. Because as Carl Rogers said, what is most personal is most general. And it's also so much easier to be yourself as opposed to trying to be someone else, especially in a romantic relationship. Now, that doesn't mean it's always easy, because it is very difficult at times to show our vulnerabilities, especially given the culture that we come from. You know, we have to put on the smile. Remember the great deception. We have to put on our best self. We don't want to bother the other person. But that won't work. Yes, it will work through the honeymoon phase. Not beyond. Not if we want to sustain lifelong, not just companionship, as Robert Sternberg said, but also lifelong passion. And it is possible. How do we know it's possible? By looking at the tip of the stem, which is exactly what David Schnark is doing. It's exactly what John Gottman is doing. It's exactly what Nathaniel Brandon is doing in studying these best relationships. It's about sharing. You know what the difference is between sharing and telling? Telling is one way. Sharing is a two-way. That's real communication. So when I share a story, really share a story, share a part of who I am, it's everyone's. It's not a one-way communication. And that's what makes great relationships over time. Another component of the happy relationships is what's called positive perception. Happy relationships have partners that are merit finders. In other words, they look at the partner and they see that the partner is disciplined rather than rigid, that the partner is funny rather than frivolous. In other words, looking at the same qualities and focusing on the positive. Qualities that can be interpreted according to the fault finder or the merit finder. They focus on the positive. Not only do they focus on the positive, they go a step further. What they have, in the words of Murray, is positive illusions. Here is one of the research that she ran. She took couples, college students who were in romantic relationships. And she asked them how they evaluate their partner according to a whole list of qualities. And then she asked the friends of their partner to evaluate on these very same qualities. And what she found was that relationships in which the partner evaluated their boyfriend or girlfriend higher than what the friends evaluated him or her, these partners' relationships were better and lasted longer than relationships where the partners evaluated their partner lower than the friends evaluated the partner. In other words, one could say, well, either maybe they're unrealistic, and she's found that also with married couples. Relationships lasted longer and they were happier if there was what she calls positive illusions. And I almost agree with her. Almost. You know what part I disagree with? I disagree that it's an illusion. Yes, it's positive, but it's not an illusion. Why isn't it an illusion? Because what these partners are doing, they're seeing something real. They are seeing a seed there. And their belief in the partner becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Let me give you an example. As I've mentioned before, I'm married to the consummate merit finder. My wife looks for and finds the positive in things, in me too. When she was in her 8th month of pregnancy, she took me aside and she said, Tal, I need more help from you. I just can't continue doing so much on my own. It's heavy, it's difficult, I need more help. I felt very sheepish about it, as you can imagine. And I went shopping that day, you know, did the shopping, and came home with everything, every item on the list that she made for me checked off. And she said to me, thank you so much for doing this. This is great help. And I said to her, I'm really sorry that you had to tell me. Eight months, I mean, I should have thought about this, right? I'm so sorry that you had to tell me. To which she responded, no, but you know what I love about you so much is that you're so responsive. So I did the dishes too. Focusing on the positive, appreciating it, makes it appreciate, makes it grow. Nurturing something that is there makes it grow. Another example. For years, I've heard this from other people. I know the people were saying it, whether as a teacher or as a friend. And many people perceived me as cold and aloof. Now my wife, when she came into the relationship, she immediately saw right through me. And she saw that I wasn't cold and aloof. Yes, I was shy, and that was interpreted by many people as being cold and aloof. But actually, I was very warm and fuzzy inside. The and fuzzy inside I made it. So she saw that. And you know what? Over the years living with her, I have become warmer. I have become more accessible to people. Why? Because she saw a seed there that other people didn't see. Was it an illusion? No, it was real. It was there. And all one needed to do was appreciate it. Not only does love perceive potentialities, but it also actualizes them. Let me show you an excerpt from one of my favorite movies. And the scene is in As Good As It Gets, when Jeff Nicholson has just humiliated his partner. Is it Holly Hunter? Helen Hunter. Helen Hunter. And just gave her, said to her that her dress looked like a kitchen apron. And she was about to leave the restaurant, and she said to him, I'm leaving unless you pay me a compliment right now, and it better be good.
Okay. Now, I got a real great compliment for you, and it's true.
I'm so afraid you're about to say something awful.
Don't be pessimistic. It's not your style. Okay. Here I go. It's clearly a mistake. I've got this, what? Ailment. My doctor, a shrink that I used to go to all the time, says that in 50 or 60% of the cases, a pill really helps. I hate pills. Very dangerous thing, pills. Hate. I'm using the word hate here about pills. Hate. My compliment is that night when you came over and told me that you would never... All right, well, you were there. You know what you said. Well, my compliment to you is... The next morning, I started taking the pills.
I don't quite get how that's a compliment for me.
You make me want to be a better man.
That's maybe the best compliment of my life.
Well, maybe I overshot a little because I was aiming it just enough to keep you from walking out.
The other thing that you can see here is the power of compliments. You know, a roundabout way for him to give compliments, but how it creates, how a compliment is actually about sharing. So, the positive perception is the number one predictor of happy relationships. If your partner evaluates you higher than other people do, and you evaluate yourself, that relationship is the most likely to succeed. The greatest good you can do for another is not just to share your riches, but to reveal to him his own. Lao Tzu, to see things in the seed, that is genius. That is the genius of Marvel Collins. Now, is anyone going to tell Marvel Collins you have positive illusions about your students? Yeah, some people are. These are not illusions. She sees a seed there. This is the mark of a genius as a teacher. Michelangelo, remember what he said about how he created David. He said, I saw a piece of marble, and in it I saw David. All I needed to do was chip away the excess stone. That is genius, to see the seed, to see the potential, and to realize it. Every great leader does it, from Moses to Martin Luther King. Able to see the seed, appreciate it, and accentuate it. The same with romantic relationships. And if the relationship is not going great, the important thing is to shift focus, to refocus. How do we refocus on the positive? Using sentence stems, Nathaniel Brandon's technique. I fell in love with my partner because, and then completing that sentence. The wonderful things about my partner are learning to appreciate the positive. Because remember the gratefulness exercise. What is it about? It's about not taking the good things in our lives for granted. Now, I've been with my partner, say, for 1 year or 2 years or 30 years. We tend to take these things for granted. Why? Because we're change detectors. We focus on change. And if, God forbid, we lose our partner, then we say, why didn't I appreciate the positive things? And this can help us appreciate the positive, not take things for granted. It's exactly like doing the gratefulness exercise. Focusing on the positive in our lives, focusing the positives in the other. Things I remember fondly about our past are. So remember I told you earlier about Gottman and how he was able to predict 94% in terms of whether marriages will end in a divorce or not? Here is how. When he asked partners to describe their past, whether it's their first date, their first fight, their wedding, or their 10th year anniversary, if they were together for that long, he saw that some partners focused more on the positive, others more on the negative. Those partners who focused on the negative were much more likely to be divorced 5 years down the line than partners who focused on the positive. Now, wedding or first date, they're usually good memories from it, or the first year, usually good memories. But partners who focus on the negative even there, it's usually saying something, that the relationship isn't going to a happy ending unless, and this is the key point that Gottman talks about, unless we change our focus from fault finders within the relationship to merit finders within the relationship. And we do that, again, remember the gratefulness exercise can transform a life by 3 minutes a day. Learning to appreciate the positives in our partner doesn't require many hours a day, a few minutes. Doing the gratefulness exercise together with our partner. I often do it with my wife, and I can't wait for my son to be able to do it with me as well. Again, sharing, focusing on the positives, on the good things. Acceptance and respect, also critical for a happy relationship. In organizational behavior, those of you taking 1508 know I've talked about this. In organizational behavior, there is a distinction between cognitive and affective conflict. Healthy teams, healthy groups are not groups in which there is no conflict, just like happy relationships. Why? Because that means people are avoiding. That means there is no psychological safety within that group. So conflict is important. However, the healthy teams are one where the conflict is on the level of the ideas, cognitive, not on the level of the emotion, personal. It's not criticizing the person, it's criticizing the behavior. And that is a critical element of a happy relationship. And we can learn a lot from gay couples and how they handle conflict. So Gottman, in his research, found that most of the things in terms of gay couples, same-sex relationships, different-sex relationships, are similar. They mostly go into the relationship for the same reason: to be with someone, companionship, child-rearing often, passion, very similar, not much differences. But he found distinctive differences when it comes to handling conflict. Same-sex relationships, men and women alike. Here is what he found, which is different from different-sex relationship. When they're in conflict, they're generally more positive, they use more humor, more affection, more touching, both men and women in gay relationships. They don't take the negativity personally. In other words, they're less negative toward the other person, and also when the person is negative toward them, they make the distinction, wait a minute, we're talking about ideas that we disagree about. We're talking about behaviors. We're not talking about who I am. I'm still validated. I'm still loved. I'm still known by the other person. So they don't take it as personally. And finally, they're able to calm down and soothe one another much better. And this is the critical element. Because in every relationship there are fights, some of them emotional, many of them emotional. The question is, how quickly do you go back to your base level? In other words, how quickly do you go back to being rational as opposed to going through what Daniel Goleman calls emotional hijacking, where you're so upset and therefore irrational? Gay couples were able to do it better. Now, if Gottman's result was lesbian couples are able to do it better, I would have understood that result. It would have been simple to explain. Why? Because women, in general, this is how physiologically they are built. Women, in general, go back to their base level of emotion much faster than men do. When men have emotional hijacking, it takes them much longer to go back to their base level. So in lesbian couples, I would have expected them to be calmer and more soothing. But Gottman found it in men-men relationship as well, which is interesting, because then there is something else going on outside physiology. And here it comes, the element of the importance of studying these relationships. What Gottman says in this article is that it will take heterosexual couples 200 years to get to the level, that's his quote, 200 years to get to the level of handling conflict that gay couples enjoy today. But what it is actually saying is that it doesn't need to take us 200 years, because we can learn from these relationships. And this is an example of a tip of the stem relationship. What can we learn from these and can apply to heterosexual relationships if we're in such a relationship? One of the things we can learn is that the focus is on the behavior, not the person. Marvel Collins, the great teacher. When you must reprimand your child, do so in a loving manner. And by the way, this applies as much to romantic relationships. Don't ever try to degrade or humiliate him. His ego is a precious thing worth preserving. Try saying, I love you very much, but I will not have the kind of behavior. Do you know why I won't tolerate that? Simply because you're too bright to behave that way. Focusing on the behavior which she doesn't like, but validating the person. Let's look at some examples. Focusing on the person, you are so inconsiderate for doing whatever. Focusing on behavior, do you mind putting down the toilet seat when you're done? That's focusing on the behavior, not invalidating the person. Person, you're such a slob. You promised to throw away the garbage. I can't trust you. Now, what response would that elicit? Versus expressing a similar sentiment, or rather expressing a similar idea, very different sentiments. It upsets me to return to a dirty home after we agreed that you would throw away the garbage. Person, behavior. Now, in relationships, very often, we don't see this distinction. And also, we very often fail to see this distinction in the way parents treat their children, or teachers talk to their students, or managers talk to their employees. Related issue, avoiding hostility, insults, and contempt. And if we do find that we are hostile, that we have contempt, refocus our attention more on the positive. What can I appreciate? It's not that these things don't exist in a relationship, they exist in every relationship. Human nature, permission to be human. The question is how much and what do we accentuate, the positive or the negative? One of the most humiliating things within relationships is when couples argue or hurt each other in public. Couples with healthy relationships sure fight, sure disagree, sometimes even say things that they shouldn't say to the other person. No one's perfect, but they do it privately. They work out, they get to know the other person, and they're being known to a great extent when they're alone. And I'd like to propose a new rule here. So we know the golden rule, right? Do not do unto others as you would not have done unto yourself. Last week, I introduced the platinum rule. Do you remember what that is? Do not do unto yourself what you would not do unto others. Because sometimes we don't forgive ourselves where we would forgive others. Sometimes we expect so much of ourselves, and we would be much more benevolent and generous toward others. The titanium rule, do not do unto those close to you what you would not have done unto others who are not so close to you. Now, how many people here have been on a first date and shouted at the person who was on a date with them? How many people just randomly walk around in the street, see a stranger, and say to that stranger that he's an idiot? Or how many people here shout at someone that they met once during freshman week? Very rare. I mean, they would really need to do something terrible in order to elicit high decibel levels from you. And yet, how many couples, how many people who have been with each other for a long time shout at one another, insult one another? Why? Because we take the good for granted. Now, some fights, again, are inevitable. But just keep in mind the titanium rule next time you're about to have a go at a partner. They deserve, we deserve better. Finally, it's about a deep friendship. John Gottman, at the heart of my program is the simple truth that happy marriages are based on a deep friendship. By this, I mean a mutual respect for and enjoyment of each other's company. These couples tend to know each other intimately. They're well-versed in each other's likes, dislikes, personality quirks, hopes, and dreams. They have an abiding regard for each other and express this fondness not just in the big ways, but in little ways, day in and day out. Love is in the details. It's not in the huge diamond ring, though that may be important. It's not in the once-a-year cruise, though that may be important. You know what it's equivalent to? These are equivalent to spikes in our happiness. It's not about the base level of our happiness. If we want to increase the base level, we need to focus on the details, on the little things. Einstein had a communication with Ludwig von der Rohe, and they spoke about quantum physics. And at some point, Einstein wrote von der Rohe and said, I'm not interested in quantum physics. I'm not interested in the details. I'm interested in what God thought when he created the universe. To which von der Rohe responded, God is in the details. Love is in the details. It's in the day-to-day. It's in the smile. It's in the flower. It's in the compliment. These are the things that day in and day out raise our base level of happiness within a relationship. These are the things that create deep, happy, sustainable, passionate relationships over time. Yeah, the big things are important, but it's mostly in the details. Because it's focusing on these details, which may seem ordinary, that are in the long term lead to an extraordinary life. All right, the moment you've all been waiting for, or some of you have been waiting for. I hope not all. How do we attract love into our lives? Now, for those of you who are in a relationship, there are a lot of things that are relevant here too, so please don't leave. The first thing, believe in love. Beliefs are self-fulfilling prophecies. If we don't believe that love exists really, if we believe that it only really or seemingly, rather, exists in the movies, we won't find love. Remember, our mind is looking for consistency between what is inside and what is outside. And if our schema says there is no such a thing as true love, maybe because we haven't seen such models, or maybe because we didn't have good relationships in the past or don't have a good relationship now, and we don't believe in it, very often it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will become real. Remember the four-minute mile. When everyone believed that the four-minute was unattainable, it was unattainable. For centuries, for millennia, people believed that happy relationships were not attainable, that they would end in tragedy, and most of them ended in tragedy. Also, when we believe that something is attainable, we open ourselves up to opportunities. Remember the luck factor article that Weissman wrote. One of the things that he wrote about, we become lucky, we get lucky by opening ourselves up to opportunities, by believing that we can be lucky. Lucky people create, notice, and act upon the chance opportunities in their lives. What are these chance opportunities? Things like the dance. What is it, Vasco? The Latino dance on Saturday night? Exactly what I meant. Or Ying, what is the other dance? Go to these dances. These are chance opportunities. Go out of your way. Go to Pinocchio tonight. Don't wait. Go hang out in Lamont. Find your perfect love. She, he is out there waiting for you to seize the opportunity. Also, throw your knapsack. Remember what we talked about when we talked about beliefs are selling prophecies. Commit to something. Say, If you're not in love now, I'm going to find love. Or if you are, I'm going to improve the relationship. Commit to something, because words create worlds. The Murray quote that we used here is a part of it. We use it when we talked about how setting goals is important. The moment one definitely commits oneself, then Providence moves too. All sort of things occur to help one that would not otherwise have occurred. Another thing, if we want to cultivate love, to find love, is first of all, to cultivate self-love. Now, many people may feel uncomfortable with this idea. I felt uncomfortable with this idea when I first came across it. The reason is because our culture looks down to a great extent on self-love, equating it, as we'll talk about next week when we talk about self-esteem, equating it with egotism, equating it with the negative aspects of selfishness. But that's unwarranted, because you see, in every single religion, every single of the great philosophical systems, the foundation is the golden rule. For example, love your neighbor as you love yourself. The golden rule presupposes self-love. Because if I don't love myself, and this is the standard, this is the golden standard that I use, how am I going to love my neighbor? How am I going to know what not to do to others if I don't know what I don't want to be done unto myself? This is the golden standard, again, in every great religion, every great philosophical system. The Dalai Lama, in communication, I mentioned this before, in communication with Western scientists, was shocked when he heard that our word compassion usually refers to compassion toward other people, to which he said the Tibetan term for caring or compassion, sewa, includes both self and others. Very difficult to love our neighbors without first loving ourselves. Very difficult to be in a healthy relationships, in a loving and lovely relationship, without cultivating self-love. Ayn Rand, to say I love you, one must know first how to say the I. Profound truth here. Back in 1983, Swan came up with the self-verification theory. What's self-verification theory? It's that basically what we talked about before. We're looking for consistency between what's inside and what's outside. In other words, if I see myself as unworthy of love, I'm going to find or create a reality where I don't deserve love. If I believe that love doesn't exist, I'm going to create a reality in which love doesn't exist. So to cultivate self-love is about, as we'll talk about a lot next week, it's about showing how worthy we are of happiness, and within happiness, of the ultimate generator of the ultimate currency, which is a relationship. The first love affair, according to Nathaniel Brandon, we must consummate successfully, is the love affair with ourselves. To enjoy our own being, to be happy in a profound sense with who we are, to experience the self as worthy of being valued and loved by others. This is the first requirement for the growth of romantic relationship. How many of you have experienced this? You know, you were in a relationship, or rather start this way. You haven't been in a relationship for a very long time, couldn't find anyone, and suddenly you find the one. You're in a lovely relationship. And what happens then? Suddenly there are so many opportunities. Suddenly, you know, men and women go up to you and want to go on a date. Suddenly you become attractive. And what do you say to yourself, sometimes to them? Where were you all this time when I was crying in bed alone? Right? Have you experienced this? I mean, it's unbelievable how it works so often. Why? Because when we're in a relationship, we feel good about ourselves. Our self-esteem is usually higher, especially at the beginning of a relationship, than it was before. In other words, we're experiencing more self-love, and hence we become more attractive to others. But we don't need to wait to be with someone to experience self-love. It doesn't mean that we need to wait, well, let me first work on loving myself more, on cultivating my self-esteem, and once I've reached a 7, whatever that means, then I'll go out to Pinocchio's. No, go tonight, go now. Why? Because going out and looking for love in and of itself cultivates self-love, even if the other person says no. Remember, self-esteem is about coping. It is not about telling ourselves in front of the mirror how wonderful we are. It's about working hard. It's about self-perception. If we perceive ourselves going out of our way and being courageous and asking someone out, that is exactly what will cultivate self-love. In other words, healthy self-esteem over time. So be courageous. Get out of your comfort zone. Stretch. Especially in relationships, because we are so vulnerable in this realm. Especially in this relationship realm, perfectionism often comes in. In other words, the fear of failure, the incapacitating fear of failure. Because we don't want to hear no, because it will hurt our ego. And you know what? Unless you're a psychopath or dead, it will hurt your ego. If it's someone you really cared about. But courage is not about not having fear. It is about having fear and going ahead anyway. Because in relationships, like in every realm, we need to learn to fail or fail to learn. Now, I was reflecting on this lecture and I made a short list of some of my failures. I want to read it to you. So you've heard about some. Rina is on the list, prominent there. Sarit is another one. Brittany, remember Brittany? That's a pseudonym for someone else that I'm not going to tell you. And there was Dahlia. She was lovely, but she said no. There was Anat, who I was sure would say yes, but she's on this list as well, I see. And there was also Sharon and Stephanie. I mean, you can see periods here also, you know, when I was in Israel, Israeli names, when I was in the US, American names. Now, so, and there's more, and, you know, if I had more courage, because there is a limit, as I said, stretch, don't panic. If I had more courage, I think Maria Tatar would probably be on that list as well, too. But she's not. Maria Tatar teaches fairy tales here. Yeah. The key is, when we go out of our way, is to be yourself. And again, remember, be known rather than be validated. Because if you're known and the other person doesn't want you, then they don't want you. If you're not yourself and the person wants you, then they don't really want you. They want someone else. So it's a lose-lose if we're not ourselves. And it's such a burden to try and impress all the time, as opposed to the lightness that comes with expression, with a desire to be known. And finally, what courage is about is just doing it. Just going out wherever it is, where the opportunities lie for you. And wherever it is that the opportunity lies for you, whether it's through friends, commit to your friends and tell them, you know, do you know anyone that I can meet? Go to one minute. Go to your favorite hangout place. Go to your non-favorite hangout place. Again, try different things. You see, because you're special, you're unique, and you're courageous, and you deserve an intimate, passionate, and loving relationship. See you next week.